Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. I don't know if you guys have noticed on the Zoom calls, but what I'm actually doing, for some reason, I've got this habit now. Let me lean back so you can see what I'm doing. When I'm introing the show, I'm going like this. Like I'm dabbing for some reason.
Dabbing.
I don't know why, but I hope that I hope you guys are okay with it. That's our super producer, Mr. Max Williams. I'm Ben. Noel Brown, thank you for approving of my dab.
More Ovaltine, please.
Drinking Ovaltine.
I'm flagging, bro. I need pep, man. It's actually not Ovaltine. It's adult Ovaltine. It's iced coffee.
Okay. I'm drinking iced coffee as well.
You know what would be good, though? Ovaltine and iced coffee. Make it like a mocha.
Yeah, a malted iced coffee. You know what? I think you're onto something, my friend, and that is a perfect segue to our continuing conversation. This is part two of the sinister influence of Little Orphan Annie, and we've already learned some weird stuff. I don't know if, you know, this radio show was before our time. I don't know if the modern world is aware of just like how corporate that show was, the radio show. We're going to learn a little bit about that, right?
Yeah, especially considering it's like highly controversial political roots as a comic strip. And then also some of that bled into the radio show, too. Very, very odd dichotomy. By the way, it was something we didn't mention in the episode, and I think we buried the lead here. I had forgotten until I was looking up some images from the comic strip that like all of the characters have these weird, soulless, vacant button eyes.
Oh, yeah. Like
what's that about?
Well, it could be just a stylistic choice, but also I'm wondering if maybe it was something that was just cleaner when it was a comic strip, but those eyes are off-putting, right? Maybe it would be too busy or too much ink, too much detail, but that doesn't make sense because you have other comics like Dagwood that don't have a problem with having normal eyes.
Yeah, it's definitely a stylistic choice, but it's a super odd one because when I look at them, I just see just nothingness staring back at me, especially this one cover of one of the collections of all of the Little Orphan Annie comics, or one of many because there were probably hundreds and hundreds of them. It's got Annie and her dog Sandy, both with these kind of really rictus kind of creepy grins and just staring at you through these vacant white eyes. Creepy stuff. And we're going to get into some more creepy stuff in terms of like advertising and targeting kids and also the super sinister, bizarro world that Little Orphan Annie occupied that potentially could have caused some wrinkles in the daily lives of the youth of the 1930s.
Yeah. And light spoilers here, perhaps most importantly, we'll be exploring how similar conversations continue in the modern day. So without further ado, we proudly present, or hopefully endearingly present, part two of the sinister influence of Little Orphan Annie. One of the big themes about Annie as a character is that she is self-reliant. The creator himself said that she lives in a vaguely sinister world without comfort. She's controversial, but she's tougher than hell. And she has a heart, like you said, Noel, a heart of gold, and a fast left. And she takes care of herself because she has to. The radio series did cut some of it sanded down some of the comic strips more sharp tones. Like it dropped the super anti-Roosevelt politics. At times, the strip reads as just a way for this guy to let everyone know through the power of cartoons that he hates FDR. But they kept the idea of danger. The episodes end in cliffhangers, and the cliffhangers are a big reason kids tuned in for the next episodes. They're also the reason parents didn't like this. They didn't like their kid thinking, like there was one episode where Annie is kidnapped at the end of the show. And parents were ticked off at this. They were calling in. They were like, you guys are being real pills. My kid is going to spend the next who knows how long freaking out, trying to figure out what happens to Annie if she survives. Because in these kids' imaginations, in their minds, for many of them, Annie is a real person.
I was thinking the same thing, Ben.
Yeah.
Like, with this being so new, it's almost like it would be hard for them to differentiate between or even understand the nature of fiction. Like, it's to them, it's so real that they would, you know, honestly respond with real emotion and real attachment. And they would wonder about their friend Annie and if she was going to be okay, you know, all this time leading up to the next episode, which surely would distract them in their thinking from school, you know?
And it happens. Yeah. You're right. That, like, I love that you said that, because that gets us to a valid point. Parents have legit concerns now. Like, this, their friend has gone missing. They're going to suck at their math homework for a while, and it's your fault.
They're, like, traumatized. Radio. Yeah.
And it happens today with, you know, to go back to a Game of Thrones example, I can't believe this is appropriate again, but the inability of audiences to distinguish fact from fiction remains with us. For an example, one need look no further than the unfortunate and very talented actor who played King Joffrey in Game of Thrones. People hated the actor, and who was a child, by the way, at the time, and would say terrible things about him and to him. And now he quit acting. What's his name?
Oh, it's something Gleason. He has a very old man kind of name. I think it's like,
yeah.
Oh yeah, I wasn't too far off. It's literally Jackie Gleason. Well, not Jackie, but Jack. He's a very old man name. It goes along with the period that we're talking about. But you're right. I mean, he quit acting and I think went into like philanthropy or something because he was just sick of getting dragged on the internet because people had a hard time separating the art from the artist.
Yeah, yeah. And Max, you said you have another example?
Yeah, I do. Obviously, you guys know who Malcolm McDowell is, right?
Sure.
Obviously, very famous from A Clockwork Orange, but he was in Star Trek Generations as the villain. Mm-hmm. And he is just hated by Star Trek community because he is, spoiler right here, the guy who killed Captain Kirk.
People
cannot discern the fact that he is not that guy and he didn't kill William Shatner. But they're like, no, you killed Kirk. You are a terrible person, Malcolm McDowell.
No. William Shatner's fine. He went to space with Jeff Bezos, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. He did a cover of Rocket Man.
He sure did. He made a film in Esperanto, I think, as well.
He loves Esperanto.
Esperanto.
It's infamous.
Yeah, it's infamously bad, but also, you know, an infamously big swing. Esperanto being what? Kind of like an invented language, right, Ben?
Yes. Yeah, it is a manufactured language with the idea of becoming a global one world language. We could do an episode on one world languages if that's interesting to anybody. So far, the majority other than math have failed at one point or another. Language continues to kind of, I don't want to say balkanize, but speciate in a way. That's why so many different versions of English exist. I have a very good friend of mine who you may have met briefly, Noel. He's an author, a wonderful author named Tim Westover. And I'm sure he's fine with me saying his name on the air. Tim is, in addition to his many, many accolades, he is a polyglot and he's the kind of guy who studied Esperanto for fun. So I asked him about the Shatner movie. He's like vice president of Esperanto publishing in America or something. And I asked him about the Esperanto movie that Shatner was in. And he immediately told me it's like a cult classic in the Esperanto community because the pronunciation is that bad.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how we got on this tangent, but it's but hopefully it's a worthwhile one.
We should do this.
Okay, awesome.
Game of Thrones to Esperanto.
Yes, and to Little Orphan Annie. So because everybody was very close to this show, in part because parents were concerned and their children may not understand that Annie is a fictional character, the writers eventually had a list of what they called the mustn'ts, which were things that could not happen in the plot of any episode. So Annie can't be kidnapped, right? Annie can't be, you can find the list online, but it's pretty interesting. And why did they do this? We know the comic strip author was out there to propagate his own political viewpoints. Mm-hmm. But when this moved to radio, it's a new era, baby. We got money coming in the door.
Totally. And we also know that Gray, the author of the comic strip, Harold Gray, there are plenty of instances where the syndicated, you know, printings of the comic strip were pulled due to complaints. Yeah. So, you know, but he was maybe a little less concerned with that. I don't know that he was like, I don't know how the syndication pay worked, but he didn't seem too concerned. But now we've got a centralized production that's going out over the wire and that's sponsored by a marketing megalith in Ovaltine. Back to Christmas Story, you'll remember that that plays a huge part of the whole Ovaltine thing. And there were literal, you know, kind of tie-ins, you know, with little prizes you could win. Similar to the old man's major award that I believe he won from some other kind of like, you know, sweepstakes for adults. But Ralphie was just absolutely obsessed with getting this Little Orphan Annie decoder ring. So you get the decoder ring and then you listen along. And then in an advertisement that's disguised as like this stirring moment, he turns the dials while he's in the bathroom on his decoder ring, only to realize that the message that it spells out is drink more Ovaltine. Indeed. He felt betrayed. He was so upset. Mm-hmm. He was absolutely, understandably, because, you know, he had to power through tons of advertisements just to even get the thing that ultimately became an advertisement in and of itself.
Yeah, and not just the advertisements he had to power through, he had to physically power through Ovaltine.
That's right.
Because you had to send in the box tops,
that's
right?
So imagine right.
The physical toll. That's no ding on Ovaltine. It's not like bad for you. It's a malted drink mix.
It has like vitamins and minerals and stuff, and it's still widely available. It's quite delicious. You know, I'm a fan of Ovaltine.
Yeah, it's not bad.
You know, it's funny though. Not to get on another tangent, but just a really quick one. There is a lot in common between the early days of radio and like the single advertiser that requires what's called direct response advertisement, like where you have to send in your box top or your code or whatever to where we are in podcasting, or at least the very beginnings of podcasting, because podcasting in the early days, there were like a handful of advertisers, all of whom required you to enter some kind of code to get a prize, to get a discount, to get something. So it really is kind of like media going full circle in an interesting way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, let's stay on this tangent for a while because it's pretty interesting. It happened when Hulu came out too. There'd be relatively little diversity in the world of advertisers, right? Like in the world of podcasting, you know, there was a time where if you heard a commercial on a podcast, there was a high chance it was going to be one of like four companies.
Exactly.
You know, the Blue Aprons, the
Casper mattresses,
of course.
Great courses.
Great courses. Yeah. And yeah, all the hits, all the good ones. And this is something that could be a weird experience for people who are listening. It was certainly surreal for us at times on the other side of the microphone. Mm-hmm. But overall, this stuff ended up being good for our shows. And we weren't in an Ovaltine position to have just one entity doing the underwriting, because they had 100% creative control over the radio show.
Yeah, Ovaltine not only did the underwriting, and underwriting just literally means that you are a primary sponsor. It's a weird term. It just means that you are, you know, have a stake in the show and you are a sponsor of the show, partially underwritten by, et cetera. They were doing the writing proper.
Yeah.
The advertising agency that was responsible for marketing Ovaltine, they actually wrote the Little Orphan Annie radio hour.
Yeah. And then they were adding stuff in all to sell Ovaltine. They were making plot decisions. They said, okay, how do we, this very Edward Bernays approach. They were thinking, okay, you know, how do we make this attractive to boys? We want boys drinking Ovaltine too. We got so much Ovaltine. We got to move on this Ovaltine. And then someone else is like, well, I don't know, boss. Let's get her a sidekick. Let's say a sidekick. We'll call him Joe. That's a name. And Joe Corntassel, he's a sidekick. Boys like hearing about themselves. So they'll buy Ovaltine too. And this radio historians think that the big success of this for the Ovaltine company and for the story of Little Orphan Annie was that this was one of the first shows of its kind in this medium that had a child as a lead character. So it's almost like taking a Christmas Carol and now it's from Tiny Tim's POV, you know, and that's something kids can relate to. It's a brilliant idea, and it spoke directly to kids who are also trying to navigate the weird stuff about the world of adults, which adults often keep hidden from children or attempt to. I mean, if you think about it, when you're a kid growing up, the world of adulthood is somewhat cryptic, is it not?
Not only is it cryptic, I mean, it's pretty depressing. I mean, this is in fact the Depression era in the United States. Parents were struggling to pay the bills. You know, I mean, it was a really tough time, and there was a lot of strife and anxiety. And this gave the kids something to latch onto, or sort of a protagonist that they could understand, but who was ultimately written by adults. So that filtered in all of these, like, again, we were talking about in the comic strip, it was much less politicized or political in the radio show, but there were adult issues that were kind of like woven into the narrative. The producers understood, the Little Orphan Annie producers understood they had to kind of, you know, really tread lightly on this stuff though, because they wanted to make sure that the kids were signing on because they were thrilled and enticed, but also that it wasn't offending their parents. The parents didn't think that they were being given too much information or it was too adult. Mm-hmm. Because after all, it was the parents that were buying the Ovaltine for the kids. It wasn't the kids that were buying it for themselves. So it was a very much a delicate balancing act they had to do once they realized what the stakes were.
Especially considering that the show itself, each episode was only about 15 minutes long. So you can tell what they're prioritizing here. Just for an example, let's go back to that clip from the episode we played earlier. And let's play something for you at the very beginning.
Here it is, 5:45 now, and time to hear more about the big new adventure that's starting for Orphan Annie and Simmons Corners. But first, if there are any of you boys and girls who don't like to drink milk, and your mother scolds you because you don't drink enough, don't forget what a wonderful help Ovaltine can be to you. Here's what you do. Instead of drinking your milk plain, ask your mother to let you have Ovaltine after this, because Ovaltine turns plain milk into the keenest kind of a treat. So chocolatey looking and good, and it tastes even better than it looks. What's more, your mother will be glad to let you have all you want to drink, because when you add Ovaltine, it greatly increases the food energy value of your milk.
So we're several minutes into the program at this point, and what we just heard was an announcer who is not part of the story extolling the virtues of Ovaltine,
promising that it would give them pep.
Yes, you know? Pep, yeah. Just so. And the thing is that if you look at a breakdown of how much time is spent telling a story versus telling people to buy Ovaltine, as much as one third, like as much as 5 minutes of every 15 minutes was all about Ovaltine. And then some stuff went down with this orphan named Annie and her sidekick Joe. And maybe a
third of a 15-minute episode. So what is that? It's like 5 minutes. So it's really only a 10-minute episode. That kind of tracks to roughly where we ended up in the proper golden age of like primetime television, you know?
I'd agree.
A 30-minute episode of a show would really only end up being about 20 minutes. So maybe a little less than a third. But
I think it was 22 to 8.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but still, right, they're definitely cutting into the time. And you could hear that on AM radio, too, for example. AM radio will often save its commercials for like a block that feels very long. So this is clearly an advertising thing. It doesn't matter who the president is right now unless the president says something really cool or really mean about Ovaltine. If they did, then I'm sure that the writers would have little Annie rediscover her political consciousness.
Well, because even though, like we said, they definitely scaled back the political stuff from that clip we heard. Again, they're talking about buying stock. You know, they're talking about like all of this kind of adult, you know, financial stuff that kids would never in a million years probably be privy to. So very, very interesting that some of that still carried over.
And let's not forget that we are still in and around the Depression era. And so most families don't have unlimited, you know, expendable income to buy like sweets and treats. So they had to market this as something that was like, you know, good for your health. You know, it would give the kids the pep, you know, and like say things like, and do Little Orphan Annie a favor and tell your mom and dad to buy more Ovaltine. And so they, you know, you could argue that it was in some small ways like a supplement. I mean, that is how it's marketed now. If you look at the front of Ovaltine, it really leans into how many vitamins and minerals are in it and all that good stuff. But we also know that milk itself already has a lot of vitamins and minerals and, you know, calcium and all of that. And, you know, to add something to milk that was costly probably would have been a tough sell to some parents if it wasn't for their kids just haranguing them about this, you know, and making it absolutely just not an option to not buy the stuff. There is, in fact, a really great anecdote in the book, The Psychology of Radio by Hadley Cantrill and Gordon Allport, where they talk about a 7-year-old kid named Andrew who loved, in the context of the book, they say, whose favorite radio show, unnamed, with a little heroine, who almost certainly was Annie, and was sponsored by a chocolate flavoring to be added to milk, which was, again, unquestionably Ovaltine. This is from a Smithsonian Magazine article about American children facing great dangers in the 1930s. I believe the one they're referring to here is marketing.
Right.
And apparently the kid got so obsessed with this chocolate flavoring, not to be named, that he insisted that his mother buy it. And after she refused to buy it, he wouldn't drink milk anymore at all. After she decided that it wasn't worth the price. And then there's the quote from the book. In vain does she suggest that Andrew derive his pep from ordinary cocoa, or at least from one of the less expensive preparations. Andrew wins his point by refusing to drink milk at all without the costly addition. So again, parents do have an axe to grind here. This is some serious arm twisting that's going on the part of their kids who are potentially being so stubborn that they could put their own, you know, health at risk. If you are to be, if it is to be believed that milk, you know, was such an important, you know, facet of kids growing up, which we now know isn't quite true either.
Well, yeah, yeah. And shout out to the concerted ongoing conspiracies of the dairy industry. Maybe not so much the dairy industry. Big cheese, though, is a real thing. Check out Cheesepiracy on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Available wherever you find your favorite podcast. Always be closing, gentlemen. So you nailed it. Yeah, there's another thing they do that is incredibly clever. And again, this is the dark shadow of Bernays. It would be described as a whoosh, whoosh, giveaway. So giveaway in air quotes. The announcer, Pierre André, that's the guy you heard do the Ovaltine ad just a few minutes ago, would always tell these kids about giveaways. All you had to do was send in one dime, and it had to be wrapped in the metal foil from under the lid of an Ovaltine can. You know, like the sealed for freshness kind of thing. You'd wrap the dime up in that. And if you sent it in, you could get things like mugs or buttons or booklets or badges and masks and blah, 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 all this other.
Or decoder rings.
Right. Merch and swag. Right. And a lot of other radio shows, to be fair, were doing this. They were offering, quote unquote, free items. But the deal is that they weren't really free because you're proving that you've bought this product. When you're sending this stuff in, it's just like sending in a wrapper or a box top. And Ovaltine, by far, according to Bruce Smith in History of Little Orphan Annie, gave away more items connected to this radio show than anyone else, any other radio show. Children would have to get box tops, labels. This happens in A Christmas Story, and they would have to mail them in for, like you said, these decoder rings, these toys, these tie-ins.
It does, and you know, the Christmas Story twist being that the message that he decoded ended up being itself an advertisement wasn't really the way it would usually go, thankfully, mm-hmm. to give them a little bit of credit. The idea was that it was actually a pin. It was a decoder pin, and it was their most popular giveaway item. But in the show, it was almost like this way of having like an interactive element in the show. It would be little things where if you had to have the decoder pin to to you know, decode it. So you felt like you were in the know, you know, but it would be little clues about what would happen on next week's episode, right? Things like send help or Sandy is safe, you know, things like that. And it would be, you know, it would give you this sense of like inclusion and like feeling like you were part of the adventure or like, you know, on her team.
Yeah, you were in on it. You had knowledge that other folks, maybe even your parents, did not possess. And this decoder, yeah, you're right. It is technically a badge. This was used pretty often. Another very clever thing they did was to conduct acts of planned obsolescence. This is planned obsolescence is when something is purposely made to not last forever, such that a company can sell you the same thing, product or service again. So these decoder devices, these badges, weren't good forever. You couldn't just get one. You had to get a new one like every year or so, because if you would try to decode stuff with last year's badge, it wouldn't work. The labels had changed. So this is brilliant because everything is centered on getting kids to sort of hold their parents emotionally hostage for more Ovaltine. And it's a true story. What happens to Ralphie is based on a true story. And his desire for this to be a member of Annie's Mystery Radio Club or the Secret Circle is 100% something that really happened to kids. Maybe to some folks who were listening or were alive at the same time. So let's talk about this. Like, the kids needed to get their parents to move Ovaltine. Kids are just little human beings, right? They needed to keep up with the Joneses of the playground. You didn't want to be that last kid who got the decoder ring or got the decoder badge and was late. You know what I mean? You wanted to be in the zeitgeist. You wanted your finger on that malted milk pulse. So parents had to battle their kids over the grocery list, and there would be more and more giveaways, but you had to buy more and more Ovaltine to get them because they weren't really giveaways. And so parents thought, well, what if we start boycotting Ovaltine? Or what if we just boycott any company that is involved with a show that we don't like? Maybe we can influence its content. And that's why those advertising execs had that list of mustn'ts for the plots, right? They didn't want to do things that parents objected to content-wise. And broadcasters would listen to this, and they would fall in line. Little Orphan Annie Ovaltine Overlords, that's a tongue twister.
Sure.
Little
is.
Orphan Annie Ovaltine Overlords, they would ultimately capitulate to the parents because they needed to keep that sweet, sweet, guilty kid money coming in, you know?
You know, and in the same way that it was kind of up to the parents to maybe shield their kids from some of this, you know, influence, some of these radio shows, and make sure that they, you know, stuck to their schoolwork and that they, you know, give like you think today, like you can have X number of hours of TV a week and that's it and blah, 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 blah. There was a certain amount of like weak-willed parenting that was going on, as evidenced by the anecdote about the kid who essentially browbeat his mother into, you know, getting him Ovaltine or else he refused to. He's like, I'll starve before I don't drink my chocolatey flavored milk. And clearly the advertisers capitalized on that. There's an article in Newsweek on December of 1934 saying if a weak-willed mother should buy all these prize box tops, her grocery budget would swell to at least $2 a week or about $35.50 today. And this boycott that you mentioned, Ben, I think, you know, they took note, right? At the very least, they decided, okay, maybe if we're in this for the long haul, maybe we should tone down the rhetoric a little bit and give these parents a break because they're really starting to hate us. At the end of the day, we need them to be on our side. So by the end of the 30s, all those cliffhangers that caused kids to be like just, you know, out of their minds with worry until the next episode came, well, those were toned down quite a bit. And this actually might have kind of begun the end of the beginning of this era of you know, ubiquitous child-directed advertising.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, though, because by toning down those cliffhangers and those dark, mysterious, sinister events, they were also removing some of the appeal that it had to children, to this young audience. The style of advertising, though, as you pointed out, still remained, and it hasn't gone away since. So what we see here is a precedent set, just like young Ralphie in A Christmas Story. We learn the true cost of a free giveaway, and we've got a, I don't know, there's so much to unpack here, because it's like the story of Little Orphan Annie is much more than what you find in the musical, especially when you get backstage and you see that she is a political metaphor, and in a way she's a defier of gender stereotypes. She's also a corporate mascot through the puppet strings of the folks over at Ovaltine. You know what I was thinking about? I was trying to have a modern what if, and we can probably find a better one, but my first thought is, what if Wendy from Wendy's had like the most popular weekly show on HBO, and a third of it, a third of the plot, every episode, no matter what, involved having to go to Wendy's and be knowledgeable of the newest stuff on the menu. Also, Wendy's released a mixtape, and I'm going to be honest with you, if you like hip hop, it slaps. I did not want it to be good. It is good.
Wendy's been doing a pretty good job on their like social media game for quite some time. A lot of those fast food brands have. They even have like feuds from time to time. You got to wonder if they are manufactured, but they're certainly
effective. God, I got Ovaltined. I got Ovaltined. Well, as soon as we end the episode, I'm going to listen to the Wendy's mixtape again. Resting Grease, also known as We Beefin'. It's a diss track for, I think, McDonald's. That's, I got to so send funny. This to you guys.
Oh, dude, I can't wait to check it out. No, it's true. And I mean, you know, a lot of the cues, as we know, from marketing, the lessons learned, you know, from this era. You can't overplay your hand when it comes to marketing. And I think Ovaltine realized that. But it's also still around. So,
yeah,
they clearly did an okay job in pivoting and bobbing and weaving with the times, you know.
And the comic strip itself went on until 2010. Mm-hmm. That's wild to me. But this, what a strange ride. We also know that there is a new, I believe there's a new Annie musical adaptation that's either out now or there came is. Out. Yeah. Have you guys seen it? Is it out yet?
I saw a commercial for it either last night or the night before. I think it's coming up. I don't think it's out
okay.
yet.
Okay. Well, with that in mind, you know, everybody, I think the point of this two-part series, as we draw to a close here, is simply this. Ridiculous History is brought to you by Ovaltine. Collect your Ovaltine box tops and send us stuff. I might have missed the larger point, Noel.
I wish we had prepared a little more. We could have given you some sort of cryptic message to decode. How do they do it? Wasn't it just like B3, like bingo results, kind of like X7, you know, like T9, yeah. Things like that?
That would make sense, because it would have to be something that you couldn't solve unless you had a codex with you, you know, because if they tried Pig Latin, people would have broke it. If they tried some like alphabet based cryptographical approach, somebody could have broken it. It would have to be something where you had just it depended on the cipher that the audience possessed. Right. I'm trying to avoid getting too into the idea of cryptography, because that itself is a whole nother mess of spaghetti, whole nother bag of badgers.
Oh, man.
But
and there's so many. They made so many of them, Ben.
Yeah.
That you can buy yourself one on eBay today for just around $35 to $50. They look like a little sheriff's badge almost. And the most pricey one that I see right up front is one that includes the actual mailer that it came in, with the actual envelope and the addresses on it and the stamps. That one's $150. But in general, it appears you can get you one of these. And it is exactly as we described, Ben. It's just a circle. That's the codex, with like a ring of letters and then an interior ring with numbers.
Crazy, crazy stuff, you know. And just for, if we could get a quick inflation calculator, let's do this. It's a reverse inflation calculator.
Zip zap, zoop bap.
Wonderful, wonderful work, gentlemen. $50 in 1936, by the way, would be the equivalent of $994.92 today.
All right. Well, I think Daddy Warbucks would be proud.
Daddy Warbucks would be proud. Yes. And we are, as always, super grateful and proud for the opportunity to explore these ridiculous stories with you today, folks. Also, this one was a two-parter to us because it hits on so many themes that are applicable in the modern day, dare I say it, maybe to some parents who are feeling some, you know, a little bit of stress from their kids who need to have the thing. And it can't be a thing like the thing. It has to be that thing, specifically that.
Oh, yeah.
It can't be a Cuddle Me Grover. It's got to be a Tickle Me Elmo.
No, that's not going to fly. Well, let us know what your coveted childhood item was. And do you like Ovaltine? Do you cream of wheat? That was another big one. Remember, we didn't even get into it, but around this time, or I guess a little later, that's when we got into things like the Kraft, you know, television, you know, hour or whatever. Kraft,
like the Colgate hour.
The Colgate hour, exactly. You know, but all of those, that they were always a single sponsor. A lot of them were done live, and they, you know, constantly bounced back to whoever the spokesperson was in a separate little shooting scenario in the studio with like boxes of the thing behind them. So let us know if you're from that era, what you remember fondly. I mean, because honestly, nowadays we just wouldn't put up with that. It's a little much, even though with the streaming and the podcasting, like we were talking about earlier, we are in a weird new space where advertising has kind of gotten clunky and weird again. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Same as it ever was. And it is sort of a renaissance in that way. You're right, because a new technology has entered the playing field. And what will the future bring? Well, hopefully we'll be with you to explore it together. Thanks, as always, to our super producer, Mr. Max Williams. Thanks to Casey Pegram. Thanks to our own little orphan Annie, Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister. Or is he more of a Daddy Warbucks, you think?
He is quite bald, as is Daddy Warbucks. But, you know, if he were a little orphan Annie figure, I mean, he's got his dog Tybalt, which would be his trusty companion for solving mysteries.
Oh, good call. Yeah, and I'll say it, he has a lovely singing voice.
He does. It's very true.
I don't know. I feel like he's more of like the sidekick, though.
Fair enough.
A Joe Corntassel?
Yeah, he's a Joe Corntassel completely.
Okay. He would rankle at that second fiddle status, but we'll see. We'll get with his agent.
We'll see what he prefers. Also, as always, huge thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme, Christopher Hasiotis and Eve's Jeff Coates here in spirit. And to you, Ben, I'm not sure which of us is which, but between the two of us, we make a hell of a team for solving, ridiculous history mysteries and, you know, beating down the man.
Let's do a Hardy Boys. Oh, we'll do a Hardly Boys so we don't get sued.
Love it. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.